The 100 Years War, the Poitiers period. King John II prepares to fight. Well, King John has a mess on his hand. Normandy is in a mess. The area down in Languedoc is a mess from the Black Prince's trip through there at the end of the year and early in the year. The English are planning to invade. He's just not really sure exactly where they're coming from. And his taxes that were supposed to be levied aren't being collected very well. So let's see what happens here. Now, King John's ministers were probably ignorant of Jean de Morbecque's mission to England, but they surely anticipated something of this kind to take place when he attacked Charles of Navarre. Certainly they were well aware of the invasion fleet which was being made ready in southern England, and of the weakness of their own defenses. There were virtually no naval forces available to stop the English landing. The Aragonese galley fleet had been mobilized and manned at Barcelona during April and placed under the command of Francisco de Porrios, a Catalan nobleman with strong Francophile sympathies who was close to the King of Aragon. But there were only 9 vessels instead of the 15 which the French had options. And there were long delays in beginning the voyage, which in spite of their long experience of foreign contract fleets, the French government had failed to anticipate. The ships did not leave the Mediterranean until July. So John II had to meet the threat of an invasion as best as he could by disposing of his forces on land. Well, the Otrebon was proclaimed on May the 14th, 1356. The main body of the king's army was summoned to Chartres on the confines of Normandy and the Île-de-France, which suggests that he knew that the English attack would come from the west through Normandy or perhaps Brittany rather than from Calais. Unfortunately, the response to the summons was poor. It had to be repeated on May the 27th and again in early June. In the ordinary course, the French government would probably have left the southwestern provinces simply to fend for themselves, but John's representatives had promised the estates at Toulouse that an army would be sent from the north to defend them. The collection of taxes in the region was conditional on its arrival. This new crisis in Normandy made it impossible to send the Dauphin, so the king's third son, John, Count of Poitiers, was appointed in his brother's place. This unimpressive 15-year-old, without experience of government or command, became the king's lieutenant in all provinces of the kingdom south of the Loire River. He was assigned a formidable body of tutors and ministers to guide him, including Marshal Jean de Clermont and Jean de Beaucaux, and a mass of noblemen and functionaries of the southern provinces. A second army was summoned to muster at Bourges at the same time as the army of Chartres in order to accompany the young prince south. As the summer wore on, the symptoms of civil disintegration multiplied, not only in Normandy, but across much of southern and central France. In April 1356, a small Anglo-Gascon army, commanded by the Lord of Mussidon, mounted a raid deep in the Quercy. They penetrated to within a few miles of the important market town of Figeac in the eastern march of the province. Here they laid siege to the small fortified village of Fons, which had a royal garrison, and the imposing seigneurial fortress of Cardillac, a few miles away to the north. Both places were taken by assault in the first half of June. The inhabitants of the region had had no warning of the attack. The French seneschal tried to raise the siege of Cardillac shortly after it began. He was defeated and driven off. The representatives of the towns and the local nobility gathered to decide what to do. In the middle of June, they collected a fresh army to fight off the invaders. Most of its troops were simply raw recruits conscripted in towns. They were wiped out by the raiders. Almost all those who were not killed were taken for ransom. The brief and destructive raid of the Lord of Mussidon was a signal for an explosion of brigandage in the surrounding regions. The raiders left a large number of new garrisons to continue their work in Quercy. Two sons of Lord Alembert were installed their men at Fons and used it as a base for plundering the trade of the region and raiding into the valleys of Lot and Aveyron. Other captains penetrated into the south of Quercy. Cahors, the administrative and commercial capital of the region, was protected by a complete circuit of modern walls, built only 10 years before. But it was surrounded by enemy forts, which paralyzed its trade. The neighboring province in Rurugu dissolved in the chaos as small groups of armed men splintered off from the Anglo-Gascon bands and roamed unmolested across the province. They seized the fortified village of Clairvaux, only 8 miles from the provincial capital at Rose. Although they held it for barely a month, the incident terrified the citizens. The consuls strengthened the watches, redoubled their efforts to build their walls, and patrolled the streets at night with torches. They hired a garrison of 200 men-at-arms. Within 14 days of the capture of Clairvaux, other raiding parties were reported to be prowling around Neujac, Melun, Saint-Affrique, Sauveterre. North of the Dourgogne, in Turin, in southern Limousin, enemy garrisons sprang up like summer weeds in dilapidated castles, abandoned monasteries, and semi-fortified villages. Poitou had been granted the young Prince John as his appanage in April, but much of it was ungovernable. The southern part of the province was controlled by Gascon garrisons. The great castle of Luzon was surrounded on all sides by English fortresses. At Poitiers itself, the citadel had not been repaired since Henry of Lancaster's raid of 1346. Gaps in the walls were being hastily filled with timber breastworks. In July, the enemy was raiding up to the gates, seizing goods and men, including the mayor of the city, who was carried off and ransomed. Every community turned in on itself, looking to its own salvation. The work of the tax collectors and recruiting officers was completely paralyzed. When the General of States met at Languedoc, reconvened in Paris on May 8, 1356, it was obvious that the great fiscal reform in December had failed. Their deliberations have not been recorded, but the terms of the ordinance which followed show that little or nothing had been collected of the subsidy. The delegates tinkered with it. Rates were altered so to transform more of the burden to the richer taxpayers, from whom it was easier to collect. Payment was ordered to be made in 2 installments, one in June and one in August. An attempt was made to cut short the endless round of petitions, complaints, and bargaining by which tax levels were traditionally set, by allowing provinces some freedom to decide the basis on which its payments would be assessed. The major concession was that the proceeds of the subsidy should be reserved for the defense of the region in which they were collected. The angry and frightened communities of the provinces might well have forced this on the government anyway, but its consequences were very unfortunate. It meant the paymasters of the army of Chartres and Bruges, in theory, received nothing unless it had been raised in the province where the army happened to be. The result of all this was chopping, changing, was chaos. Normandy, which had long ago appropriated the right to regulate its own taxes, ignored the decision of the Estates General. Districts of Lower Normandy resolved upon a sales tax to be levied at the punitive rate of 5% from June. This seems to have superseded the income tax, which they had approved in March. It was superseded in turn by 14 days later in an assembly representing the whole of the province, which decided there should be a hearth tax of 10 sous from July. This was followed by a maelstrom of protests as attempts were made to collect all three exactions, and taxpayers refused to pay any. In other provinces, the paucity of surviving records makes it hard to say what happened, but suggests that probably nothing did. When the king had agreed to reform silver coinage demanded by the Estates General at the end of the previous year, he had almost certainly anticipated a final glut of income from the mints before the new regime of stable currency reduced it to a trickle. Unfortunately, events conspired against him. There was a steep rise in the market price of silver in the first half of the year of 1356. This made it impossible for the mint to buy bullion and still make a profit by coining it. The traditional solution was to pay more for the bullion and reduce the silver contents of the coin. Well, that had been ruled out by the terms of the king's agreement with the Estates General. The government devoted increasing attention to the problem as the prospect of collecting the subsidy declined. Nicholas Brock and Jean Paulet-Villain, the two principal experts on the art of coinage manipulation, were brought back into the Chamber de Comptes to see what could be done without repudiating the ordinances of November and December. The truth? Nothing could be done. Two of the greatest provincial mints at Poitiers and Saint-Pourquin ran out of metal in May. The mint at Troyes ran out in July. Others, like those of Toulouse and Rouen, continued to make coin, but secretly reduced the bullion content. As the troops began to arrive at Chartres and Bruges, the government was at wits' end to find money for their wages. So things are really bleak for King John here. He's practically lost control of half of his country in brigandage. He can't seem to get any taxes. The people he's trying to collect it from, their towns have been devastated. They need to fix their towns. Now the price of silver has gone up, which is not a surprise with all the warfare going on. That's surprisingly it hadn't gone up prior to that. Now he can't even make it off the old-fashioned dodge of depleting the coins of silver. So things are a mess. It's interesting when you look at this in another view. In the context of teaching the Hundred Years' War, I don't have years to cover the topic, obviously, like I've been doing on podcasting. And I do a week on the Hundred Years' War. Most people, it's like, nah, that's just going to pass by. We'll just mention a couple of things. So you hit the battles, you do the causes, you do some other things. But what we've been seeing in doing all these podcasts on this subject is that it's not just exhaustion in between the main battles. It's financial catastrophe in most cases. And then this brigandage and the continued infighting. You know, we think of, Edward III wants to become king of France. Well, now we find out, or we have found out, that Charles of Navarre wants to become king of France. There'll be another one. And then there'll be the Dukes of Burgundy, along with the King of England. So it's not a surprise that things are quite messy. From my standpoint, it appears that at the rate I'm going to have to pronounce or mispronounce practically every town in France before this is over. Well, as you know, the sources for this, Pierrois' 100 Years' War, Nyland's 100 Years' War, and the 100 Years' War, Volume 2, Trial by Fire by Sumption. Don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com. Ask a question, leave a comment, check out our topics on CDs or USBs, and as always, thank you very much.